Oh, أسمك نهزة طالسي
Welcome to this month's segment of Tongue in Cheek. I'm Emma, your host. This hour is in honor of Ukraine's oral and aural cultures, in sonic solidarity and in response to the atrocities being committed by Putin's neo-imperialist war machine. We hold this thought close throughout, that sonically, Ukraine, and all that this noun for a nation encompasses, has always been sovereign, as we listen to only a tiny smattering of what UNESCO would class as intangible heritage, and in some instances does, although its official list barely scratches Ukraine's sweeping musical milieu, incubated and made rich by mixed language practices and resilience in and around migrations, absorptions, diasporas, itinerancy, whose folkways have either been sustained or revived in the face of spatial conflict and repressive regime changes within its long contested territory. Kobzars, for instance, were itinerant and often blind bards, whose practitioners Stalin's regime nearly completely eradicated in the 1930s and then folklorized in its wake. Interestingly, serzhuk is a term for mixed language practices or sociolects in Ukraine specifically, but that are neither Ukrainian nor Russian. Its etymology comes from Proto-Slavic for with rye, referring to different mixtures of grain alongside rye, as if a kind of linguistic bread mixture, just as Ukraine is known as Europe's breadbasket. This hour highlights some amazing sonic efforts against erasure, among them the Polyphony Project, an immense digital archive of village-based and mostly female-led singing practices that use ancient vocal techniques from across Ukraine. These songs were sung in part while farming, and so the physicality of farming and of singing at loudest volume so as to be audible over activity writes itself in. And the Chernobyl Song Project, initiated by Ukrainian ethnomusicologist Marina Sonovitsky, which revives ritual song repertories from the region surrounding the accident site. A professor at Bard, her research centers around sound and sovereignty in post-Soviet Ukraine. After a few such songs, we'll be joined by Yael Strom, a composer and klezmer pioneer who's traveled widely in Eastern Europe and Russia, and in some instances transcribed tunes that hadn't found their way onto paper.
Ой, ти, мамо, я волю, де ти діла мою долю,
чию морі утопила, чи в печі.
Як була ти малою,
нагору ж на тебе несла ще й ведро з водою, нагору ж на тебе несла ще й ведро з водою.
Було б тобі, моя мамо, мене не носити,
а спалити положити, та й не колихати, а спалити положити.
Ой, нехай би я кричала,
нехай би я даю Бога, доленьку благала, нехай би я даю Бога, доленьку благала.
Ой, у полі висока могила,
ой, у полі висока могила, на могилі червона калина.
На калині чорний ворон кряче,
на калині чорний ворон кряче, на чужині сиротина плач.
Ой, казали сиротині люди,
ой, казали сиротині люди, вийди заміж, краще тобі будь.
А я людську воленьку вольнила,
а я людську воленьку вольнила, вийшла заміж, голівку втопила.
Утопила в глибоку криницю,
утопила в глибоку криницю, вийшла заміж за гірку п'яниць.
Що п'яниця все п'є та гуляє,
що п'яниця все п'є та гуляє, прийде додому, як не б'є та клай.
Сам лягає на кроваті спати,
сам лягає на кроваті спати, а мене становить голубів ганят.
Ой, гуль-гулі, голубоньки з хати,
ой, гуль-гулі, голубоньки з хати, не збудіте милого з кровать.
Сама знаю, коли збудити,
сама знаю, коли збудити. Ой, як стане сонечко сходить.
So I'm happy. Testing. Yes, we're back. Happy to welcome our guest, composer and klezmer musician, forgive me, of the Hot Pastromies, who had shared that song with us. Yael Strom, I have you on the line. Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Emma. And thank you, listeners all over the world. Thank you.
So tell us what we just listened to.
So that was a tune, a folk melody, that I just called it after the town of Skylava. So it didn't have a name per se, but I figure that's where I learned it from. And the very short of a long story is I was doing some ethnomusicological research back in the early 90s in the Carpathian Ukraine. Mm. One of my specialties is the instrumental genre, music known as klezmer, that predominantly Jewish musicians played in Eastern Europe. But I also was fascinated with Romani folk music, and also both Jewish and Romani and its relationship with the local indigenous Ukrainian music, as well as the mountain people, the Hutsul, Boyko, Lemko, Ruthenians that lived in Carpathia, Ruthenia. So anyhow, and so I was told to be at this village train station at like 8 a.m., I'll meet this musician. He'll know who I am, even though I didn't know who he was. And I'm waiting 8 o'clock, 8:30, 9:30. About 10:30, I was really about to leave. Well, the truth is, I couldn't leave because the next train didn't come until about 3 o'clock. It really was a village of about 100 people. And I hear this music, what you just heard, only one instrument playing the melody. And I go, wait a minute, that sounds like a cello. How in the hell is a cello getting closer to me? I mean, cello has an end pin. You usually straddle it. You're sitting in a chair. And here was this Roman gentleman named Pichu Bachi, or Uncle Uncle Pichu was his endearing Hungarian name. And and the rest is history. He taught me that song, many others. And he said it was a tune that he learned from Jewish musicians in the 50s. Mm. But he said Ukrainians played it as well. So I guess the long and the short of it is here's a beautiful melody that was played by all Ukrainian, birth, in the sense that, out of the Ukraine, though, of course, then Ukraine in the 50s was a Soviet Ukraine. But that musicians enjoyed it. And guess what? People liked it. And those who just listen to it can start slow, but it gets really moving. And it's about rhythm, and it's about getting people to dance and celebrate. So I'm glad I was able to share this with you.
Brilliant. Now, so it's a song that would have been passed back and forth.
Exactly. Across communities. Now, passed back and forth. Now, what that means also is the different minorities, because of their particular folk traditions, would add their nuances, their ornamentation, the way they perceived. It's like, very simple, it's like someone saying, I'm going to create a goulash for you. Well, goulash is a type of Hungarian stew soup. But if Jews have that, Roma people have that, Hutsul, Ruthenians, Slovaks, Ukrainians have stews and soups. It depends on what spice you add and the main flavors. So you had the basic melody, but then it was the ornamentation that added its own particular musical spice.
Right. You also get at both the limits and opportunities of different languages being spoken.
Certainly. Now, language in itself, as I am speaking English, and everyone who understands English understands the language, and when I say the word violin, you have the image in your brain, your mind, a violin. What's interesting about these musicians is, music is the lingua franca of the world. It really is. I mean, I could take my violin now and go to the heart of Madagascar and not speak, a word of whatever the local languages are. But here's some rhythms, here's some melodies, and before you know it, I'm jamming and speaking a language in conversation with them, where the other person who's with me but doesn't play any instrument. It's just kind of course, admiring it and having a good time, but not having that conversation. But the Jews did. The Jews spoke Ukrainian, spoke Ruthenian, Ruthene, that's similar to Ukrainian, but different, or Polish. Mm. The Romans spoke Romani. Jews spoke Romani. There were Roma, people who spoke Yiddish fluently, better than I. So, yes. So, literally, language was back and forth. And particularly musicians, if you are working with other people outside of your in-group, right, the endogamous, clannish in-group, as we all see the world like to be, and maybe that's why we have lots of problems. But that's, we'll say that for another another day, another radio hour.
Yes.
But musicians say, hey, yes, I'll learn your language, at least enough so we can talk on the bandstand a little bit afterwards during the break, and back and forth. So musicians were multilingual, definitely.
Right, and then so were listeners. Must have cultivated an incredible aural intelligence.
Very much so. The listeners would, and they interpreted the songs differently depending on their own particular cultural background.
Right. And as you've described, many of these songs were played at weddings.
Right. Folk musicians, whether you were Ruthenian, Hutsul, Ukrainian, Jewish, the most popular and best attended gig, though they wouldn't call it a gig, in Yiddish we would say simcha, celebration, but most popular celebration was what? It's a wedding, right? You've come of age, and you're married your beloved, and you're continuing on the tradition of family, of the language that you'll pass down, the food customs, the crafts customs, your religious beliefs, and for the next generation. You know, it's all about survival and keeping a culture alive. And that's why also these peoples would try to marry within their closed groups, because some just because let's not pretend that was a panacea. There was prejudices and biases all the time. But they might say, I like you, Mr. Jew, or I like you, Mr. Roma, or I like you, Mr. Ruthing, but I am not that, and so I want to marry my own group, but we'll play together in the music stand. But when it comes to raising the children, not quite. And that's, we see that in 2022, in March of this, today, whatever today's date is, the 26th, I think it is.
Yes, yes.
So they would. It would. The music meant different things to different people. But weddings, you come to celebrate life, a new beginning, and if people want to be happy, and it's about the rhythms too. Yes, they hear a melody, they may hear words, and they'll sing along. But people lose themselves in dance, because dance is a physical manifestation, I believe, of showing your love of something, of yourself, of the partner you're with, of the group you're with. And physiologically, you have endorphins. People know the word, what's it called? Getting highs from your own endorphins. Mm. And so dancing does it. And you know what? When we get a high, we keep going back to the source. So people love to dance for many hours.
Right. And in a funny way, it feels like dance has a lot to do with what is called white voice. You heard via the Polyphony Project certain tracks just before the one that Yale had selected for us. But it's a highly physicalized sort of throat, head and throat oriented voice.
Right. And what's so beautiful about that, so here you're listening. Now that's very different than that. This kind of raucous sound you just heard, this kozachok, which is the Yiddish term for a kazachka, a Ukrainian Cossack dance. There it's more meditative. You're really lending those voices and the words, if you understand it, transport you to another place. It's meditative. It's being sung by women, where the bands, generally, it was a sexist world, sorry. It's just the way it was. Though there were women playing music too. Instruments, particularly with a family band, they would. But
men were accompaniment.
By yourself on the highway, byways. It was more dangerous for women. So being it less rhythmical, less loud, more meditative, it takes you in a different place. And there would be these songs during breaks in a wedding, but not too many. Mm. But it'd be okay now in the church afterwards, a toast is being made. Someone wants to sing something in particular to the newlyweds so that their new paths are strewn with roses, with blessings, et cetera. You know, good luck, good fortune, you know, money. And so they'd sing these songs, and then people would join and clap, sing along. But then, of course, they'd go back to, okay, now let's get the drums, let's get the other instruments, whatever they may be, and let's start up to dance. So there could be a combination at a wedding with this. So some people might say, this would only be heard in a more meditative church-like, home-like. Often it was, but you could still have these beautiful songs sung even at a wedding.
Right. Is there any relation between monody or the kind of chanting practices that developed in early Orthodox music?
Well, that single voice, the single melodic line that could have instrumental accompaniment or could not.
Yes, but the voice carries all.
Yes, well, what I've read is that's coming from the church. Well, the Greek Orthodox, the Ukrainian Orthodox, Ukraine, you have the Ukrainian Orthodox Church where their metropole is in Kiev, and they are Ukrainian Orthodox. And then you have the Greek Catholic Orthodox, particularly in the Carpathian Ukraine, that still look to the West, to the Vatican. So it's an interesting combination. But anyhow, Jewish music or local indigenous folk music is much older than these religions.
Mm.
Yeah, religions are old, but the people have been living here many hundreds, thousands of years longer than these religions. And so I think this monody type of singing came from the local indigenous music, and you certainly hear it in the chanting of Jewish music. And others. We were talking the other day about this type of music called heterophonic. Where you have the monody, you had you and me singing together in one voice, Emma, just a different timbre, but the same octaves. But I start two beats later, one beat later, and I'm in a different part of the room, so there's even a bit of delay. So what happens is you're getting this interesting sort of harmony that's like, well, is it really harmony? It kind of sounds harmony. It's like, are they really together, the voices? And it creates this kind of inner
mm-hmm.
tension.
Mm-hmm.
So that sometimes happens, particularly in the Jewish tradition of praying, but you would even hear that sometimes in the Orthodox Church, particularly in the ones that were lay led, so you didn't have someone who was like more experienced choir leader singer.
Yes.
People were just more amateur, and you know, and everyone says, "Oh, I know how to sing and have the melody." So, and then you get next to the person, and you say, "Wow, what a beautiful timbre!" And you go 2 feet to your left, and you say, "Oh my God, that person, can he hear? He's a half step quarter tone flat,
yes.
But he's singing with his heart out."
Yes.
And so it creates those intertensions. So even in the monody, yes, you would get these different layers, different oral audio layers.
Right. And the delay experienced within heterophony does feel like a schism paradigmatic of mountain audio as well, you know, how echoes and hollows set up feedback loops. Because, again, the heterophony, as you have mentioned, grew out of Carpathian mountain musicking practices.
Yes. Yes, yes. So you have like, I guess in West Virginia we say the hollows, you know.
That's where my mama is from.
Oh, there you go. Well, shout out to her.
Yes, she's listening.
And what's interesting is because of, you know, these deep valleys and these peaks of mountains, and 90% of the livelihood was off the land, agriculture and cattle raising and various kinds of farming and having orchards. You know, some crafts, obviously, shoemaking and leather and wood. But you know, it's definitely something with the land. So, and people didn't travel far. They had no need to. They had, you know, all their wants were there. But to communicate, there's actually, they would use the alpine horn, alpine, you know. Mm-hmm. Or I know in Romania, they call it the tulnitz. Tulnitza. My wife does a song that kind of the voice mimics that. But it's a, they say it's the longest instrument in the world. It's like 9 feet. So yeah. Think about trying to hold it. In fact, sometimes if you're not strong enough to hold it, they put stands, and you know the bell is kind of fitted into this kind of little stand. And you
wow.
But it was done to communicate.
Mm-hmm. Across distances.
Hey, having a wedding. Hey, sadly, there's a funeral, et cetera, et cetera. And then also, you take a simple song that everyone knows, and just 50 kilometers away, that same song that they grew up with, they knew it, but it changes just slightly. Because mm-hmm. all that has to happen is the fiddler who introduces it or plays it the most or is the leader of the music in that village. He decides to add a bar or slow the tempo down or add a note here and there. They're not going to say, oh, you're not playing authentically. They just accept it because he's the master of that trade. And okay. then it becomes, so in less than a generation, that folk song that's been around hundreds of years has changed, and it changes. So, yes, so you have similarities, but you have also these regional differences, and all due to geography.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, do you think nature's own sounds would have had a hand in the development of onomatopoeic musicking? And perhaps...
I would think, yeah, you hear the birds singing... Particularly birds and the beautiful singing. There are stories now, I'm going to say, folks, of a man named, his name was, who came from the Carpathian Mountains, Ukraine. That's where we're focusing on. His name was Israel ben Eliezer, Israel the son of Eliezer. And he was a rabbi, but he was the founder of the philosophy, the Jewish philosophy, that came about in the 18th century called Hasidism, a Kabbalistic philosophy. Mm. You can go very deep in it. We could have literally hours and hours of discussions of what it means to be Hasidic in the philosophy. But simply, I'm going to give it kind of in a simple two sentences.
Yeah.
Basically, the founder, Israel, he said, let's connect to God in a direct way. You know, whether you're a scholar or not, whether you study Talmud or Torah or whatever it is, you have the right, because you are a human being and God created you to have that direct communication. And so when you do that communication through prayer, it should not just be ba 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 ba, it should be sung. So the communication is through sung prayer and then just sung onomatopoeia songs. So they say that Israel, the son of Eliezer, the founder of the Hasidic philosophy, who passed away, folks, in approximately 1760. Listen, he would go into the woods to be with nature, and he was sort of an herbalist as well. So he was learning from the peasants about, you know, various kinds of plants that heal you and tease and so forth. But he would listen to the birds and other, you know, the flora and fauna, I guess, so to speak, in the wind through the trees, and said he was influenced by the rhythms and tonalities to create some of his own wordless melody. So definitely, and if he did it, why wouldn't other groups of people living in the Carpathian Ukraine, and folks, that's southwest Ukraine, if you're listening, you're not sure what that is, it borders it borders southeastern Poland and eastern Slovakia and eastern Hungary and northwestern Romania. And it's very much Ukraine, of course, in the news very much today. So you're right. I definitely think nature, because people were living with nature. That, you know, their cows and goats and sheep and chickens and roosters and turkeys, you know, that were domesticated, and then just all the other wild animals that they lived among.
Right. Nature was their radio.
There you go. Yeah. Nature is a radio. But sometimes if you wanted to turn it off at night, it might be impossible. Will you quit that meowing? Will you quit that chirping? I'm trying to sleep.
they would have, you know, caused to speak in tongues as well.
Exactly.
So do you think we should play the Lemko, the Boyko, or the Hutzel?
Yeah, well,
track?
Let's see.
Yeah.
I have it up here. Why don't we go, let's do that Hutzel, or let's do that Boyko one.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do that one.
This is a tune also from the Carpathian Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? The Boyko?
Yes. The chorus was, I think actually it was a part of the Ukrainian national chorus, but it was a melody there that they were being sung, the Boykos, which is this, of the small minorities, when I say small, I mean just they're, you know, in terms of numbers of people that live in the Carpathian Ukraine, they're kind of the farthest east of the Carpathians, and some even in the province of Bukovina, which is the capital city of that province of Ukraine, is Chernivtsi, and Chernivtsi, they would say, excuse me, I said it the Romanian way. Romanian rule. The borders were always changing.
Yeah.
But the point being is they've done DNA stuff, and they find these are the people that are least related to the rest of the minorities in that region, that they are more related to Central Asian, and maybe even, you know, Mongols, and so forth. So it's very interesting.
Mm.
But, you know, but they live them, you know, the minorities, they had great musicians. They play, you know, the kopsa or the bandura. They play the drimbaurs. We call it the jaw harp, or some say the jew harp. And in fact, that's a very popular instrument among these different groups. There is the drimba, where you're just, you know, your mouth becomes the cavity, the sounding board, and you, depending on how you shape it, and when you're plugging it against your teeth,
right.
It takes a while. I bite it, and boy, man, did my front teeth hurt. You know. I was playing it improperly, but...
Yes, yes. Virtuosic.
Yes.
No,
I'll stick to the violin.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so much more that we should cover. I think this calls for a sequel. But I think perhaps I'll just play through a series of other songs in the time that we have left.
Please do. I think then the people listening can kind of with a little bit of the information we've given them, you know, enjoy it and understand it in their own way. But it just shows you the richness of the music culture in Ukraine. Sometimes we just think, oh, Ukrainian folk music is just one type of music, and you know, it's just like in any culture, you have the umbrella. Here's the word umbrella: Ukraine, Ukrainian folk music, and coming down are many different strands depending on the region of Ukraine and the different people that live there. That it sounds similar, but it's still different.
Exactly,
and it has its own unique tradition.
I might play two tunes, two lullaby tunes from various ritual song repertories for that very reason, both kindred but also divergent, plus a few more polyphony project tracks and a punk folk tune by Daha Braka.
Oh, yeah. That will be, folks, stay tuned to that one. You'll love that.
Thank you, Yael. We hope to get you on very soon.
Yes, Emma, it was a pleasure, and to everybody who helped put it on, and a shout out to Timmy, I hope you're feeling better.
Yes.
And speedy recovery, and yes, Emma, we'll definitely be in touch. Goodbye, everybody. Have a wonderful rest of the year.
Thank you, Yael.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Люлі,
люлі, чужим діткам дай подулі, Андрійку калачі, щоб Андрійко спав у день і вночі. Люлі-баю-баю, а я своє дитя мале дай приколихаю. Приколишу, пригойдаю, сама піду трошки погуляю. Ай, люлі, 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 налетіли гулі, посідали на воротях у червоненьких чоботях. Люлі, люлі, люлечки, шовкової та вірвечки, золотої бильця, приколишу чорнобривця, приколишу, пригойдаю, сама пойду погуляю.
Кату, кату, каточку, Паша в каток на той куток, дав крав собі сала шматок. Люлі, 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 усім діткам подулі, а моєму дитяті медика лаче, щоб спало в день і вночі.
Ой, да ті колеги, ножку розмалє. Ти не з того не став.
край. Надо регене круто.
Ой, да ты не стой, не стой,
на.
Не спускай голяна
синее море, ой, да як на сего моря корабель плывет,
ой, да як на то
Breakfast in Venice. Breakfast in Venice. Spring pageantry. Wow. Absolute spring. A Roman bedchamber. A Ukrainian mystery. March spring. Evgenia Belarusets.
Thank you. Шарагванчик, рыжчик, ванчик, рыжчик, нестый размах, нестый, я лопухогу.